I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Five areas in Kansas City are being looked at by investors this week as potential sites for economic development. These sites could mean more jobs and more locally owned businesses. Today, we'll talk about these federally designated opportunity zones that are spread throughout the city. Learn how they were chosen, what types of investors are wanted, and how these could economically regenerate distressed communities. Then, summer is in full swing this week. The sun is out, temperatures will be high, and we'll be looking for something cool to drink. Master of Wine Doug Frost will be here with libation suggestions to beat the heat. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The newest economic development tool in the drawer at City Hall. It's called an Opportunity Zone, and it's designed to encourage new investments in economically distressed parts of town. It's done through the tax code. This is an overlooked part of the tax reform package that President Trump signed back in 2017. Kansas City is taking a hard look at the potential of Opportunity Zones at a summit taking place the next 2 days at the Chamber of Commerce. Now a conversation about what Opportunity Zones could mean for Kansas City. With us, Bruce Katz is co-founder and the inaugural director of the NOAC Metro Finance Lab at Drexel University. Bruce, welcome back. Nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Herb Hardwick is founder of the Hardwick Law Firm. Herb, good morning to you.
Good morning, Steve. Great to be here.
Bruce, what's an opportunity zone? Explain this in layman's terms, if you would.
So in the tax law of 2017, Senator Cory Booker from New Jersey, Democrat, Tim Scott from South Carolina, Republican, put in a provision which basically said to individuals or corporations with capital gains, listen, we'll let you defer paying taxes on those gains, reduce them, or even eliminate future investments if you invest in a so-called opportunity fund, and then that fund invests is in an opportunity zone, a low-income census tract that is designated by the governors of the states. 8,762 opportunity zones have been designated in the United States. Kansas City, Missouri has about 30 plus of them.
You know, Herb, am I wrong here? It didn't seem that this notion of an opportunity zone got a whole lot of attention when the Tax Act was signed. Am I right about that?
That is correct.
Yeah, so where did the interest in this come from in Kansas City?
I think what happens in Kansas City, like a lot of communities, we're always looking for resources to impact development. And I think developers now see that opportunity zones can be another redevelopment tool to stimulate investment in the urban core.
You know, Bruce, you were saying before the show that you think Kansas City is ahead of the game here by a considerable margin.
You're way ahead, actually, because think about this, 8,762 zones all across the country. How is an investor, either locally or nationally, going to find the investable projects, particularly those that enhance communities, build wealth? So what you did in Kansas City, you're only one of a few dozen cities. You created an investment prospectus so that you could unveil the assets and advantages of all your zones and then begin to identify projects that are investor-ready and community-enhancing. So you're one of a few dozen of cities that actually jumped ahead of the curve.
And Kansas City has these projects, some of them ready to go?
I think you have multiple projects that are ready to go, but you also have a vision that this is just not going to be project after project, but that they're going to add up to basically regenerate neighborhoods in an inclusive and sustainable way.
You know, Herb Hardwick, why is Kansas City ahead of the game here? Who's spearheading this drive?
In this instance, you have the Kansas City Chamber, you have the Kauffman Foundation, and you have community stakeholders who are coming together to collaborate to bring forth this whole initiative and to provide information and resources to the investment community to help bring these projects forward.
We're joined now by Ross Baird. He's a board member of Village Capital in Washington, D.C. I want to slow down just a little bit here, Ross. What kind of potential do these zones have for cities like Kansas City around the country? What's your sense from your vantage point here and what this could mean for our community?
You know, Bruce and I have been in about 50 cities across the country over the last year, and we have been doing this work for a decade plus. And I would say the energy in the last 12 months exceeds the energy in the last 10 years of people wanting to put capital in their hometown. I think everyone wants to buy local, craft beer, local food, but very little money is invested local. Very little money of people who live in Kansas City is invested in Kansas City. And I think what we're seeing is a very narrow window of time where people are asking very intentional questions on where is my money invested? What am I doing in the world? What am I doing in my community with my actual dollars? With my and so it's accelerating a conversation that should have been happening for a long time, but is now actually happening.
So are we talking about investors investing in small businesses here? Are we talking about larger scale projects? What are we looking at here?
It's all of the above. So one of the challenges with community investment in the past has been it's been very project dependent. You know, here's a corporate headquarters. Here's an affordable housing project. It's very domain dependent. But if you think of the idea of a street corner that is successful and thriving in your head, there's commercial activity. There's a bakery. There's a vibrant series of stores. There may be a larger company that's headquartered there. There's housing there. And I think thinking of all of those different activities that go on in a thriving city in one bucket, in one investment all at the same time, investing in a street corner versus investing in a deal is a metaphor that we've used to describe what we see happening.
So, Herb, these are small mom-and-pop type businesses. These are larger scale housing developments. Am I seeing the range of possibilities here correctly?
Absolutely. There's a spectrum. I think you can be as creative as you need to be. All projects need some form of capital, and this becomes another source for them.
Mm-hmm. And for investors then, Bruce, this is a significant tax advantage. I mean, what's the advantage of going this way as opposed to a TIF, a tax increment financing method, which has been fairly controversial in Kansas City, a fear that developers are getting too many breaks? What's the advantage of going this route?
Well, for these investors, they get to defer or reduce paying capital gains taxes. Selling a stock, selling a building, so forth.
Yeah.
But also, this is really built for more long-term thinking. So if you hold your investment for 10 years, at the end of the 10 years, let's say you invested in a new startup company, you don't pay any capital gains tax on the new investment.
Mm-hmm.
So this could be quite interesting because it's forcing investors that, frankly, might have put their funding in a private equity firm or a venture capital firm or a wealth management firm and invested in the coast. 80% of venture capital in the U.S. is invested essentially in Silicon Valley, Boston, and New York.
Mm-hmm.
It's forcing them to think about, well, hey, wait a second. What about a startup in Kansas City? What about the ecosystem in this community? It's changing the geography of investment given what is essentially a tax relief for people with capital
gains. If that startup in Kansas City takes off, just
right,
to understand what you're saying about the tax implications here, the investor doesn't pay on the increase, just on the initial investment?
Well, they still have to pay their capital gains tax reduced on their initial capital gains.
Okay.
But it's the new investment which is treated differently. So that's what is interesting about this.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I think the intent of the sponsors, again, Cory Booker and Tim Scott, were thinking two things. There's a lot of money that's built up in Silicon Valley, in Boston, in New York, and elsewhere. Can we bring that into the heartland for real market returns? And then there's also a lot of local wealth in places like Kansas City. Can that invest locally?
Hey, Ross, in your sense early on, is that there's a lot of interest in going this route for investors just based on what you're seeing?
I think there's a lot of interest. I think the barrier right now is people want to see this come to life. So there's been a lot of theoretical conversations around opportunity zones over the last 18 months. I always say in entrepreneurship, it's better to be specific even if you're wrong rather than vague and right. And when we're seeing specific projects go to market, we are seeing them be invested. So I was working with a group in Austin, Texas, for instance. Austin's very similar to Kansas City in that the downtown has really thrived over the last decade, but East Austin has a 15-year lower life expectancy than West Austin. And much like Kansas City, it's cut off by the highway. So I worked with a group of community organizers. There are no health clinics. There are no grocery stores. There's no business infrastructure in East Austin. I work with a group to come up with a project that would build a community health and wellness center. It took 9 months to develop that project. It went to market, and that project was fully funded in 3 days by both local and national investors.
Wow.
And so what we've been doing with the Kansas City Chamber and the Urban Neighborhood Initiative has been doing that hard work to figure out what the right projects are. I'm very confident that when thoughtful projects go to market, the capital is there. The groundwork is at the community level is what's happening right now.
Have investments been made in Kansas City as of yet, or is that still to come?
I think it's still to come. And there have been a couple of one-off deals where an individual will put their own money into a property. But there haven't yet been any transformational community-driven investments. But this project that the Chamber and the Urban Neighborhood Initiative have been leading has created a prospectus of probably 20 deals that have community buy-in. We've gotten investor feedback. The returns pencil to be attractive. So if you can follow up with the KC Chamber to figure out what these deals are, they're about to go to market at a big investor summit that will be hosted this afternoon.
Herb, can you describe what some of these projects are in a little more detail? What are we looking at here in Kansas City?
Oh, you have a range of commercial projects, residential projects that are down on 18th and Vine area, kind of throughout the urban core.
So housing we talking about?
You're talking about housing, you're talking about mixed use, you're talking about commercial development. So you'll have a menu, if you will, of options in order to invest these dollars.
How much of a difference do you think all this is going to make? What are you expecting to happen here?
I think in the short term, I think as Russ and Bruce have pointed out, that as it gets traction, I think that this could be transformative. Because you have a new source of capital that has not been available to date, and it can drive projects in a way that has not been done. So it can be a new way of financing urban redevelopment, and everyone can win. I think the caution, and what I'm hearing from neighborhoods and community leaders, is that they don't want investors to come in and unilaterally invest money in projects that are adverse to their interests, if they will. They would like for there to be some collaboration. So that's a nuance that we're working through as we go forward. But as all things, you have to kind of navigate a process to figure out what's optimal, if you will.
So we're seeing national interest in Kansas City and maybe some local interest too, Herb?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay, if people want to join our conversation on Opportunity Zones in Kansas City, they can use the hashtag WeGrowKC on Twitter or call us 816-235-2888 or tweet us again. Use the hashtag WeGrowKC on Twitter. Bruce, what's the process to gain this designation? How does that happen?
Well, it's already happened. So basically what the federal government said to the governors, you designate the zones. They gave them criteria. Ultimately, there were about 37,000 census tracts that were eligible in the United States. They chose 8,762. So that has happened. The zones have been designated. And Kansas City, in my perspective, and I think Ross as well, having looked at the country as a whole, designated well. You have a whole series of areas that are close to the downtown, close to nodes of growth. There is market potential, but as Herb says, it really has to follow and align with what the community wants. They want workforce housing. They want local business, minority-owned business, female-owned business. Perhaps there are some energy plays, even fiber infrastructure. So you have an investment prospectus. You have a narrative about the assets of these places. And now you're actually holding an investor summit. There's very few of these that have been held yet in the United States.
Huh. Is most of the interest, Herb, in housing? Is that where most of the attention's going or not?
No, I think it's spread out pretty evenly. I think you're looking at commercial development as well as the mixed-use projects. Housing is important, but I think commercial development is going to be key in this area.
How much investment might we expect here? How many millions of dollars are we looking at?
So the prospectus scoped out $100 million worth of projects. Here in Kansas City.
$100 million.
And I'd say when people think of community development, they do think of housing because we're living in a legacy system where largely community development has been housing. One of the issues, though, with housing, and I know the Kauffman Foundation has been a convener of this process. The Kauffman Foundation is focused on entrepreneurship and building wealth through building your own business. One of the issues with housing is most housing that's been built, people are renters. And if you're renting your house, you can't build wealth. You build wealth by owning your home or owning your business. And a huge part of this 100 million scope of projects is ways that people in Kansas City who are today renters can become owners, or ways that people in Kansas City who are trying to start or grow businesses can grow equity in their business. So I'd say I'd say the most interesting projects are the ones where 10 years from now we say, look, the investors made money and they think Kansas City is a great place to do business, and that's good. But here are thousands of people in Kansas City who are much wealthier than they were 10 years ago because their equity built in the projects.
Herb, two thoughts here. The percentage of renter-occupied housing here in Kansas City is like at 50%. It's very high. So this potential is huge. And just to give this perspective of $100 million that Ross just threw out, to put it in perspective, that's the total value of the entire run of the 1/8-cent sales tax this community passed a couple of years ago. Absolutely. Roughly $10 million a year for 10 years, $100 million. We're suggesting here that we could see all this coming in addition to that, in the years to come.
That is a great observation, Steve. We at the opportunity, on behalf of the Central City Economic Development Sales Tax, we believe that opportunity zones coupled with investments from 1/8-cent sales tax, also coupled with enhanced enterprise zone designations, there's another tax abatement play that can be integrated into that. So when you take the $100 million projection that Ross just pointed out, the $100 million from the 1/8-cent sales tax, you have the ability to probably create $300 or $400 million in terms of synergy that from an economic development standpoint. So if this happens, if it works, it could be a boom to cities like Kansas City and throughout the country.
And Bruce, you're not seeing any reason why it won't work here in Kansas City based on what you're seeing in the early going so far.
Well, you've got to do the math. Mm-hmm. You've got to have real projects. You've got to work through the so-called capital stack. What's the equity investment look like? What's the debt from conventional banks? Herb has essentially public incentives to put into a deal, and there may be other forms of concessionary capital. In a way, this is forcing us to relearn how do we design, finance, and deliver projects that can actually build wealth, as Ross has talked about.
You know, again, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about Opportunity Zones, a new one aspect of the Tax Reform Act of a couple of years ago that was overlooked initially, now being applied in Kansas City. Again, Herb, one of the big concerns early on with that 1/8-cent sales tax on the east side was how to leverage that money to get the maximum bang for the buck there. Is there a possibility that can happen with these opportunity zones being sort of combined with the 1/8-cent sales tax?
I'll share this with you, Steve, and the audience. Big picture, we are in a round right now, or the commission, the 1/8-cent sales tax commission, is reviewing proposals. Some of those proposals contain opportunity zone financing. Mm-hmm. So you're starting to see it manifested as we speak. So we think that it will have an impact, and it will have an impact on projects that are going to hit the urban core. So the answer to your question is yes.
Is the word out around town about the potential of these zones, or is it still a sort of a secret kept within certain quarters of town?
I think it is starting to slowly come out and permeate the community. The business community is well aware of it. Now the goal is to make sure that the public and the community stakeholders have not only aware of it, but understand how it works, the impact and ramifications of it.
Ross, I imagine that educational component's going on all across the country right now, people sort of figuring out what this is all about.
Absolutely. I mean, I do think that one of the things that has been different about opportunities is most people think in two pockets. You know, business lives in one pocket and philanthropy and government and policy live in the other. And this is the merging of the two pockets. We have private capital trying to accomplish things that are good for the city in ways it hasn't before. And so we're seeing some very weird conversations. We have community organizers and very wealthy people and very poor people in the same room talking about the same thing that never would have happened 2 years ago. So I do think that we have some odd bedfellows and new coalitions in a very helpful way in Kansas City and across the country. I think like an Etch-a-Sketch, it's shaken up a lot of really kind of tired and ineffective ways of thinking.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, Herb, it's about time. Isn't it just what Ross just said? It's about time.
It's a watershed. I mean, it's wonderful. It's beautiful. It's first time. It is that moment for us to come together and change the paradigm. If we don't take advantage of this opportunity now, it may be lost. So I think there's a lot of enthusiasm and excitement to try to bring all the forces together in a positive way to make this happen.
Bruce, you're sensing this same kind of synergy, too, as you go about your work here?
Absolutely. And the interesting thing about Kansas City is that if you invent something here, other cities are going to look at you and adapt and replicate and scale. So this is not a normal federal tax incentive where you waited for the rules and then you just followed the rules. There's an enormous amount of innovation, imagination, creativity, and community engagement happening. And cities are watching each other. And mm-hmm. Kansas City is being watched by others. They know you're ahead of the curve.
The office of Sly James all over this, Herb, and then incoming Mayor Quentin Lucas will be engaged here as well, I'm sure,
right? Well, absolutely. The city has been a major stakeholder throughout the entire process.
Let's go to some phone calls here. Rob from Kansas City, Missouri. Rob, you're on the air.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it.
Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, I told your producer, your discussion is kind of conceptual, but there is actually an opportunity zone entity that is in creation right now. It's called Equity Squared under the auspices of AltCap, which is a Kansas City Community Development Financial Institution. And that's important because an opportunity zone has to take a capital gains event within 6 months and deploy it in a project. That's why it's important that these are kind of shovel ready. And that entity is now starting up. So anybody that wants to investigate actually investing in or understanding some of the projects can call AltCap and get that information directly. So there is real energy around this as well as the conceptual energy.
And what is the investment going to be in, Rob? Are we talking housing, business? What are we looking at here? Or all of it?
Well, as your guests have said, all of it. There are mm-hmm. lots of opportunities. AltCap has already got partnerships with Uni, so they can use the list that you talked about through Uni. And other projects will obviously come to the fore as the Opportunity Zone concept gets traction.
That sounds good. Rob, I appreciate your call. Ross, are you familiar with AltCap?
We are. So AltCap is an example of a local institution that has been making a really important shift change. So historically, community development has been debt and lending, and the Opportunity Zone incentive is equity investing, which allows investors to be patient, but you know, investors will build more wealth and entrepreneurs will build more wealth over time. And AltCap has really been a nimble and flexible institution that's responded to this shift in the market really admirably, and I'd say is one of the most forward-thinking community development institutions in the country.
I was going to say, help people out here, Bruce. If folks are still a little confused about what all this is, there's a two-day summit coming up beginning this afternoon at the Chamber. That's a place to go get more information, and where else can people go figure all this stuff out?
Well, I think there's a website that mm-hmm. Kansas City has created. I think it's kcopportunityzone.com.
Okay.
So if you just Google Kansas City Opportunity Zone Investment Prospectus, you're going to get a treasure trove of information.
Okay.
What's really important is that we start with, yes, this is what the law enables, but Kansas City has gone through the hard work of zone by zone describing your assets, your advantages, the socioeconomic profile, and then projects. And so this is what every city basically has to do. You just did it ahead of everyone.
How many zones do we have here in Kansas City?
I think you have about 32. Yeah.
Okay. And mostly east side, Herb?
Throughout the city.
Throughout the city.
Throughout the city.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
So there's some industrial zones, Blue Valley. I mean, there's a mix. Yeah. It's sub-geographies that have certain kinds of characteristics.
Joan from Prairie Valley. Joan, good morning.
Oh, good morning. I just had a question.
Yes.
About small investors. How would a small investor approach this project if it's available to small investors?
Ross Baird with Village Capital. Tell us how.
Yeah, so the real work, and I guess to your earlier question of what will it take to make this happen, I think the real work – to make this successful happens at the fund manager level. So AltCap is an example of an organization that is creating a local fund for smaller and larger investors. If you go to the website, you'll see others. So to invest in a project, you do need to go through a qualified opportunity fund. And we're seeing funds popping up all over Kansas City led by local business leaders. So we will be collecting that information on the website, but AltCap is just one example of funds that are in formation.
Joan, why is it appealing to you?
I'm retired, and I'm always looking for ways to get a good return.
Okay. I'm glad you called. Thanks, Joan.
You're welcome.
We're going to have to leave this conversation there. Again, the Chamber of Commerce going through a two-day summit on opportunity zones that begin this afternoon. Call the Chamber for more information. I want to thank Bruce Cass, who's been on this show before. Again, co-founder, inaugural director of the NOAC Metro Finance Lab at Drexel University. Herb Hardwick with the Hardwick Law Firm. Ross Baird, a board member of Village Capital in Washington, D.C. This is just really intriguing stuff. Please stay in touch with us about what's going to happen here, okay?
Absolutely. Thank you, Steve.
You bet.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Just ahead, Master of Wine Doug Frost with summer drink suggestions. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, we got details on the year-long facelift the Truman Library and Museum will undergo starting this summer. Hear that and other previous episodes at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, African Proverbs of Wisdom. We'll talk with a KU professor who's collected these sayings into a wonderful book about what they mean to him. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, let's call them beverages for adults on a warm summer day. That's what Doug Frost will be laying out for you today, how to beat the heat with a cool summer libation. Doug Frost remains one of four people on the planet Earth to have achieved the twin distinctions of Master of Wine and Master Sommelier. The New York Wine and Grape Foundation just announced this year's impressive roster of judges for the annual New York Wine Classic Competition, and Doug is one of them. Doug, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Always nice to be here.
Well, some news from your world before we get into the imbibing here. I saw on your Twitter feed that the Manifesto and Monarch Bar just made the top 10 Central U.S. nominees for Best Cocktail Bar from the Spirited Awards, and that the Rieger just made the top 10 for Best Restaurant Bar. How significant is all that?
Well, it's really cool. I mean, Tales of the Cocktail, which puts out the Spirited Awards, is universally recognized, and so it's great to see Kansas City get the nod. I mean, Monarch's an amazing place. Manifesto is a benchmark. Rieger's doing great stuff. So
that's a big deal for local places to get this kind of national distinction, I think.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah. Well, let's turn to good summertime libations here. Isn't this a tricky time for drinking because, you know, it's hot and a lot of times people don't want anything too heavy, Doug? And
yeah,
it's a different kind of time of year.
Yeah, I think people need to, show some restraint this time of year.
Ah,
I think it's really important to make sure that you are properly, shall we say, properly watered down. You know, I certainly think people should always make sure that they are making certain that they're getting a lot of water, you know. So I think it's important to have – sorry, I'm making a little bit of a mess here. Danny's looking at me. So I think it's important – yeah, thank you. I think it's important to make sure that you drink enough water. Every time you have a glass of wine, every time you have a beer, every time you have a cocktail, you need to make sure that you have a glass of water as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really would tell people to be cautious about that. Sorry, I'm going to let you crack
Why is that so important? Because, I mean, cocktails are liquids. Why do you need to have more liquid in the form of water?
Because alcohol is a diuretic, and you certainly need to make yourself safe, and you certainly need to... make sure that you're staying watered down.
Alcohol just dries you out.
It does. It absolutely dries you out. So it's really critical, I think, for people to understand that they should go ahead and make sure you drink a lot of water. So in this case, what I have here, I'm just shook it up I don't know, Chris. You had a shake you're going on over there. Why don't you take that shake real quick too? Because we wanted to make sure people could hear the difference between hard ice and soft ice. So that's the sound of hard ice getting hit.
Sounds hard to me.
Yeah, and why don't you shake yours, Chris? You can hear it's kind of crinkly. It's kind of, you know, there's...
That's soft ice.
Yeah, that's soft ice. And the reason that that's so critical, frankly, is because soft ice just dilutes really fast. It dilutes your drink. You know, the idea with ice is certainly you're going to dilute the drink to some degree, but you don't want to dilute it too fast. And crappy ice, as far as I'm concerned, it just, you know, makes your drink...
So ice matters in a good cocktail,
is
what you're saying.
Ice definitely matters.
And how do I get hard ice then? Can I make it at home or...
You can, but to be honest with you, it's difficult. It's certainly an issue where most freezers have a lot of air bubbles inside the ice, so that's one of the reasons it breaks down quickly. Basically, if you could slowly, you know, very slowly turn your water into ice, you're likely to get fewer bubbles, or just buy it from somebody really good. You know, there are vendors out there now.
Well, that's the voice of Danny Alexander, the up-to-date producer. We're also joined by KCUR's Chris Young here. I didn't realize that ice was such a big deal.
Honestly, I didn't either when he asked me to make sure he had some ice in there. He probably knew I was going to pick it up from a bag from the local convenience store. And he goes, yeah, did you get it from a local? I said, yeah. And he goes, yep, it's going to be crappy ice.
So you have to go to a liquor store to get hard ice, Doug?
Well,
that's a good place to go?
I'd say, you know, go talk to your bartender at a good place, because those bartenders are very serious. If you have a bartender that's serious about ice. And like I said, for me, it's just a matter here. Danny, I'll hand you this cocktail. This is a very low-proof cocktail.
Okay. Am I sharing with anybody?
I'm
sure.
I think you probably should. There we go. You know, if you're at a bar and you hear that kind of slushy sound when they're making a cocktail, that's not very good ice. And maybe you might want to pick a different bar. If you go to a bar and it makes that really loud, wonderful percussive sound when somebody shakes a cocktail, talk to that bartender about where you might get some good ice.
Yeah. Well, I'm just learning something all the time here. So this first drink you're passing around is a pace car, right?
Yeah, we call it the pace car. This is something that a great bartender actually tells of the cocktail bartender of the year winner some years ago named John Lemaire. He passed away last year, and so we actually celebrated John Lemaire Day last Friday, and everybody drinks pace cars because Johnny was a smart boy. You know, we hung out a lot, we partied a lot, but he would drink this drink on a regular basis, and it's basically just a little bit of Fino sherry, a little bit of Dolan Blanc vermouth, a whole bunch of soda water. You might throw a touch of bitters in there. You might throw a piece of lemon in there.
Yeah.
And it looked like you were having a cocktail, but he's basically drinking something that's like 4% alcohol.
Okay. But you can still you don't miss the vermouth.
It still has flavor.
Yeah, but it's not as, it's very subtle, but it is lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry, Doug.
Chris Young, have you had a sip of the pace car yet? What do you think of this thing? What's your first reaction?
Oh, you know, as far as summer cocktails, you just can't go wrong with something light like vermouth. It's perfect. It's low ABV. You can make a session out of it. But also, you know, if you're done mowing the lawn on a Saturday and just need something refreshing to kind of reward yourself, a little vermouth and soda is never a bad way to go.
Huh. And vermouth gives that little flavor, that so it's not a flat tasting like a spritzer, a wine spritzer. A spritzer? Where are you from? Like a wine spritzer would be.
Chris, you have a little background in this world, right?
A little bit. So I've been bartending in Kansas City for about 5 years now. Mostly beer bartending. Wine is not my forte, but I've been craft bartending quite a bit lately, so that's given me a lot of opportunities to play around with vermouth. And, you know, just to piggyback on what's been said, it is so nice for cocktail making because depending on the vermouth you have, you can make some really bold flavors accentuated, or you can do something very subtle, very just simple, like adding it with soda.
Mm-hmm. You know, Doug, what is vermouth? Because, you know, I got to tell you, I hear that word, and for some reason, I think of my parents. That was a word I heard a lot at my home growing up.
Well, yeah. I guess... your parents had martinis.
They did. They were big martini people after Dad got home from work.
Yeah, the idea that there is no vermouth in a good martini is just anathema to me. Vermouth is essentially a flavored and aromatized and oxidized, or at least partially oxidized wine. So it's just white wine that's been allowed to kind of go bad and then flavoring elements are put into it, and it's fortified. So it's about 20% alcohol, or as much as 20% alcohol, I should say. And that's it. It just provides flavor and adds a depth and complexity to your Manhattan if you're using sweet vermouth, or to your martini if you're using dry vermouth, and on and on and on and on. And by itself, still to this day, if you walk into a bar in Europe and say, yeah, I think I'd like to have a martini, about half the bartenders will pour martini and Rossi over ice into a glass dry vermouth, because they're like, isn't that what you wanted?
You just asked for
martini.
Yeah, right,
it's like,
right.
No, I want like a gin. You have to explain it.
Well, which spirits do you prefer in the summertime? What are your go-to spirits come June, July, August?
The truth of the matter is I drink mezcal on a nearly daily basis. So, you know, I'm just going to be honest.
Full disclosure.
Yeah, it wouldn't matter what season it was. But yeah, I do think that a lot of us think of the so-called white spirits, the gins, tequila, vodka, rums and things like that. And then in the summertime and have more thirst-quenching cocktails, lower alcohol cocktails, more citrus-based cocktails, things like that are more refreshing. And then, come the wintertime, people think about their Manhattans and their Negronis and such, although Negroni week is this week. So, you know, who knows?
Well, what's the key to a good gin and tonic, which is sort of the drink I like in summertime?
The gin and the tonic.
Well, okay. Danny put it exactly right. You know, I mean, the tonic's got to be fresh.
About
at a minimum, make sure you're opening a new bottle.
Yeah, that's the key there.
If you see it come out of a gun, you're not going to have a good time.
That's not a tonic.
Yeah. Which that drives me crazy, to be honest.
And people
honest
like
with you.
They have their, I mean, everybody has their vodka that they like or their gin that they like. And once you get used to drinking a certain type, you can taste it immediately and you know if you've asked for it, if you've gotten the right thing. Yeah. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, if our listeners want to chime in with a question for Doug Frost, this is a great time to call to get some of the best advice you can get anywhere in the world. 816-235-2888 is our number here. Or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Doug, you just passed around some white wine. Tell us about this.
Yeah, passing around a little Le Bourgeois Brut. It's a sparkling wine made from the Vidal Blanc grape, made here in Missouri. I think it's really solid stuff. I like taking it around and showing it to people outside the area because people are always just amazed when I tell them, no, it's Missouri wine. These are Vidal Blanc grapes, a grape that is what so-called French hybrid, but one that's been grown successfully here in the middle part of the country for at least a couple of decades.
We're getting a fairly vigorous nodding of the head from the up-to-date producer, Danny Alexander.
Oh, yes,
and
you
when
are.
Danny's happy, we're all happy. And so what's your sense of
I think Doug's made an excellent pick here. It is beautifully balanced. It has, and you can't, my thought is, it's hot weather is the perfect time for a sparkling wine.
Yeah.
It really is because it just is lighter by nature because of the bubbles. This is not too dry, and I know a lot of people, I don't like a super sweet. And I know a lot of people don't like a super dry, and this just hits that spot. I mean, yeah, I could stop and buy a bottle of this on the way home tonight.
Can I make you crazy?
Sure.
Chris just shook up a little bit of cucumber soda, and it's basically just soda water, cucumber juice, a little bit of sugar. And so I just poured some Le Bourgeois on top of it. You know, again, you can come up with these really low alcohol drinks that are really refreshing. Anybody can make strawberry juice or something like that. Throw a little sugar in there just to kind of sweeten it up. Maybe a little citric acid to tighten it up, or lemon juice or whatever. And then just pour sparkling wine on top of it. And it is one of those.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
Boy, that's.
And that was not carefully measured. I basically just poured it into a glass.
Really,
there is like nothing to argue about here.
Right. And I actually think I prefer this to like a cucumber flavored, which I've had, vodka or other. I'd rather just do it this way. So it doesn't, because sometimes, depending on the brand, but sometimes those cucumber vodkas are a little too cucumbery, if that's a word exists.
Sort of artificial.
It is a little bit, yeah, sometimes.
Yeah, it can be.
I think you just made a fantastic cocktail.
Isn't that? It's one of those.
Yeah, it's nice and vegetal. It's got a little bit of sweetness and savory to it. And the mouthfeel, the real effervescence of the wine, is just like nice tickle on your palate. It's not offensive, but it just really kind of mixes nicely.
It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, maybe we'll just all sit out on my porch tonight after
we're making plans, people.
We'll have a cocktail.
That's exactly what it's for. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Again, our number, 816-235-2888. Doug Frost, Master of Wine, Master Sommelier here. So where are you traveling in the weeks to come, Doug? You're always on the road. And what's up next for you this summer?
I just got back from Greece, and that was pretty marvelous. Kidding. I got to see my youngest daughter get married. So that was...
In Greece,
yeah.
Well,
it was
good for her. Good for you.
It was pretty
congratulations.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Headed to Phoenix tomorrow, just trying to help some people with a project down there, a vineyard project in southern Arizona. I know that sounds crazy, but just like we can grow wine here, they can grow wine there. So it's something that should be fun. And then from there, I'll head back to Walla Walla, working on a winery project up in Washington. I'm just driving myself insane, basically.
Well, it's just kind of a life. You get paid to drink for a living, and which I guess was the master plan a number of years ago. That's just not a bad place to be.
It's true.
Is it as fun as I would think it would be?
Yeah, I feel like I should figure out a way to slow down, and I know certainly my wife would agree wholeheartedly with that. But
is that the problem? You have too many demands, and people want you to come and test this and taste that.
I'm just too curious about all of it. And so it's always fun when somebody suggests a project. It's like, well, that sounds like fun. And so I'm the definition of squirrel, squirrel. I'm just like, ooh, that sounds like fun. Ooh, I'll try that too. So yeah, I'm endlessly amused. Here, what we have coming up, we've got a Riesling right now, but what we have coming up is a project that I kind of helped with at Boulevard Brewery, where we did a wine beer hybrid. So we can talk about that too.
What is that?
Literally, what we did. Ryan McNeevy at Boulevard reached out for me and said, we've got this clay amphora. We've heard that people ferment things in them. We're trying that. What would you do? And I said, well, I would certainly do, I'd like to do a wine beer hybrid. And he said, yeah, we've played with that. Let's do that. So I got a bunch of Vignol grapes from some buddies of mine, and we threw them in the amphora. We threw in there some wheat mash and created a fermentation inside the amphora. And then Ryan did all this. I just stood around and went, what a cool idea. And it then left it in there for a couple of months and have made a sort of sour beer / wine. So it's neither a beer nor a wine or both. I got a bottle of it right here.
When's it going to market?
It has. We only made a small amount of it. So it was only at the beer hall. I think they still have some at the beer hall, but I brought one of my bottles. So I thought you guys might want to try it. But until then, we have a little German Riesling, because summertime for me is German Riesling.
And you have never wavered from
I
that.
Have never wavered. Yeah. It's really true. I like these things.
What do you think of it, Danny?
Sorry. I was in the middle of a swallow.
Excuse me. Bad timing.
No, that's okay. I actually have to say, in all honesty, I don't want to say I don't find it as strong as I usually find. It's a little weaker than a lot of Rieslings I've had.
Sure.
Yeah. It's not bad. It's but I, for me, kind of middle of the road.
Well, I agree with that, by the way, just from...
Yeah, no, that's totally cool. This is Zilliken, who's one of the greatest, honestly, for me, one of the greatest producers in Germany. Hang on. This is her Butterfly Riesling, which is their everyday drinker. It's by the glass at restaurants and things like that. It's a nice, simple... nice, simple drink, and so it's not meant to astound anybody. It's meant to go
down.
It's
meant to be middle of the road.
Yeah,
Chris.
Oh, I love this. It's balanced for me, but I'm getting some like citric notes out of it that are really lovely, and that's exactly what you kind of want out of a hot, on a hot day. You want it something that's going to quench your thirst, something with just a hint of that kind of citrus in it. And this for me is just that. It's very subtle, but it's there. It's present, and I'm really enjoying it.
Subtle is a kind way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go to some phone calls at 816-235-2888. Jim from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Morning.
Hi.
Hey, I just turned on the radio and heard a little bit about the cocktails and wanted to let listeners know that the Missouri Craft Distillers Guild has launched a Missouri expedition. And today from 5 to 7, there's about 15 distilleries at Restless Spirits doing samples for customers.
How cool is that?
Where is Restless Spirits, Jim?
That'd be North Kansas City.
Okay. From 5 to 7 tonight, yeah. You might have a lot of people there as a result of all this. I hope you do. Yeah.
Well, let's hope so.
Okay.
And that's all I had.
Thanks, Jim. Appreciate it.
Bye.
Now you're passing out a fourth beverage here, Doug. What do we got?
So this is that crazy love child. I guess we would consider it part of that lineage. This is that beer wine hybrid. Now it's a sour beer, so I have to forewarn you, if you're somebody that loves super hoppy beers, this ain't your guy. If you like a dark malty rich beer, this ain't your guy. This is a sour beer that is also half wine, more or less.
You said Vignolis?
Vignol, exactly. Wow. Is the grape, which is a Missouri grape, or I should say a grape that's successfully grown in Missouri. I think it's maybe our best white grape. You can see dessert styles, you can see dry styles. I love the grape. grape. I think it does fantastic things here. And so I thought it'd be a fun thing to play with in the amphora. Danny's making a sour beer
Danny's
face.
Puckering.
I know. I actually am very much liking this. Summertime is about the only time that I will drink beer because to me, some days when it's really hot and you've been out working in the yard, as Chris said, you know, you want to reward. And there's sometimes just a cold beer does the trick. This is really rather, it's kind of, in a way, reminds me of the funkiness of a Norton.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's got that, and I think that's what the mash brings to it, is that funkiness. And it's not overly, but boy, it has a great nose on it, too. And this could be a new story. Have to go and get some of this for hubby.
Yeah, there you go. Chris?
Is that lactobacillus I'm detecting in there?
It sure is.
Look at you.
That is a lovely souring agent.
Yeah.
That is fantastic.
What did you just say?
Lactobacillus.
Of course you did. Wow.
You can almost get it on the nose. It has that musty kind of funk to it. Mm-hmm. And the aroma of sours, especially with lactobacillus, just have that wonderful kind of, you can smell it right there.
It's a little
there,
bit like cheese.
Yes.
You know? A little bit of cheese.
Brettanomyces has its own distinctive smell. But man, I love a good, you know, kind of that pungent sour. And it's actually, it's more on the aroma than it is on the palate for me, which I really enjoy. It's not a salt on the senses. It kind of washes over the palate.
And this would be great with a cheese and charcuterie plate.
Oh, absolutely.
Really, it would just be marvelous.
Chris Young is like a poet.
I'm telling you.
Just absolute. What happens to beer sales in the summertime? They spike?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, Fourth of July is the beer holiday, as it were.
Okay, beer sales, you say they go up in the summertime, and what spirits sell the most in summertime?
We certainly see things like tequila going up a lot in the summertime. There's no question, again, that we seem to see a lot more spirit sales in the white spirit category more than the brown spirit category, and the same happens with wine. It's something where we see a lot more white wine sales in the summertime than we would normally see. The world kind of turned upside down back in the early 80s when the whole red wine craze started. Up until then, red wine was a minority drink in the U.S., and then it became a majority drink, and it hasn't really turned around since. So I think summertime's a good time to crack open all those crisp white wines and enjoy those.
Yeah, but before you go, and I got to go in just a few seconds, why are there only four people in the world who have both the Master of Wine and Master Sommelier designations?
I think for most people, you finish one of those and you're good. Yeah,
This is a big bite of the apple, right?
Yeah, the average amount of time it takes to get through the Master Sommelier is 5.5 years. The average amount of time it takes to get through the MW is 7.5 years. So, and each one has a less than 2% pass rate or so each year. So it's just a pain in the ass.
That's a huge investment.
Well, and you have to be deeply insecure like me to feel like you need both.
Yeah,
you know,
we got to leave it right there. Doug Frost, again, Master of Wine, Master Sommelier. Doug, it's always a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me, Steve.
Danny Alexander, Chris Young, thanks for helping out today as well.
My pleasure.
I appreciate
it. Happy to do it.
Tomorrow on the show, will tensions in the Lee Summit School District ease now that the staff that they will receive diversity training? We'll ask those at the center of a controversy. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Emily Aiken. I'm Steve Kraske. And you are up to date.